QSO Today, Episode 76, Doug Crompton, WA3DSP. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, your host. I was first introduced to Doug Crompton, WA3DSP, over the last few years that I have been experimenting with ALLSTAR, the internet linking protocol for ham radio based on the Asterisk phone system. Having grown up in Southern California and now living in Israel, I wanted a way to talk back on FM to the old country using the internet. ALLSTAR was my solution that allowed me to link my backyard repeater to hundreds of similarly equipped systems around the world. Doug and his team have built upon the foundation of ALLSTAR, created originally by Jim Dixon, WB6NIL, to allow the simple construction of ALLSTAR nodes on the microcomputer boards BeagleBone Black and Raspberry Pi 2. What fascinated me about Doug was his attention to his documentation, not only for this huge project, but for all his other ham radio activities. To my way of thinking, Doug is the consummate Elmer, who I wanted to share with you on QSO Today. WA3DSP, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Doug?
Yes, I am.
Doug, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the very beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, I guess it kind of started at birth. I don't have any people in my family that were in engineering or any technical field. My father was in journalism. My mother was a school teacher. My grandfather on one side worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad. I have a lot of people in my family that work for the railroad. It goes way back. And they were, in fact, one great-grandfather was a telegrapher. So I guess you could consider that maybe something to do with it. But from the time I was, 2 years old, I always wanted to look at wires, and I wanted to go in people's basements when I went in their house. And I was always interested in finding out how things worked. So I guess probably even when I was, quite young, 5, 6 years old, I used to listen to shortwave radio, and my grandmother had an old radio in her house, and I would turn it on and listen to hams in the neighborhood. I didn't even know they were hams at the time, but I would hear people talking on the radio. And of course, back then, most of the communications were AM and not sideband. So it was very possible to listen to these communications. By the time I got to be, 10, 11, 12 years old, of course, in school, science class, we were always doing science experiments. In junior high school, I made an enormous Tesla coil that was entered into the science project. But it wasn't until I was about 15 that I became licensed. I'm not sure why it took so long. I probably should have been licensed before that. But I did build several kits, night kit, span master, regenerative receiver when I was probably about 12 or 13. I built intercoms from Knight Allied Electronics at a fairly young age. So by the time I was licensed, I was pretty well advanced into understanding things. I was licensed June 7th, 1965, and as a novice. And I started off fairly strong. Working CW, of course, that was the primary thing that you worked as a novice, trying to work all states. And I was on the air a lot in the beginning. My first transmitter was a Knight kit. It was a Knight T60 sweep tube transmitter, about 50 watts probably. You were lucky if it probably had 40 watts output. But worked a lot of states, made a lot of contacts. At that time, I had built a receiver from Heathkit. It was an HR10 Heathkit receiver. So that was my first station. The Heath HR10 and the Knight T60, both kits. And then later on, I homebrewed some transmitters using 6146s and 807s. I went on to a Hammerlin HQ110 receiver. So that's kind of my early time in radio. There's probably a lot more stories that I could tell about that. But
how did you feel when you got your first novice license in the mail?
Oh, I was elated, you know, because back then you had to wait till you actually got the license. There wasn't any pre-license period, which I think there is now. Well, you had to get your call. So, I mean, now if you have your call and you advance, you can use the advanced privileges with a special suffix on your call. But, you know, back then you had to wait in the mail, came in the mail. And, of course, as a novice back then, you were tested by a single person. And I guess they had to be a general or above. I don't know if they had to be more than a general. But it had to be just a single person that would give you the code test and the written examination, and of course send that into the FCC, and then you got your license in the mail and your call letters. So yeah, it was pretty exciting. My mailman was a ham, and that's another interesting story, because when I was a novice, I got a lot of QSL cards. And one day a QSL card came, and it was addressed to WA3DSP, Glenside, PA, but that's where I lived. And I got the card, you know, and I was just amazed that I could get a card with my call letters on it and just Glenside, PA. Well, it was because my mailman was a ham, and he knew, or he could look up in call book, you know, WA3. I guess it was WN3DSP, not WA3DSP. But, you know, I got the card in the mail. It was kind of exciting.
Did you have any Elmers or mentors who helped you along in those days? Do you remember who they were?
Yeah, I did. Quite a few. I had a friend that was a ham, K3WQQ. His name was Mike Foster, or is Mike Foster. And he was probably my first experience with ham radio to actually, you know, be friends with and talk to a ham. There were many others. You know, I lived in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and there were many clubs at the time in the area, and many hams in the area that would help me out. I later on, and I'm not sure, it probably was, you know, just about the same time, but maybe a year or two later, we had a ham radio store in Philadelphia. And these are very rare now, because most of the stores are, you know, big box like HRO and AES, et cetera. But back then, you know, there were ham stores all over. And we had a ham store in the suburbs of Philadelphia, called Hamburgers, because the man that owned it, Howard Berger, W3BAH, you know, he started the store and he called it Hamburger after his name. I was his paper boy. He lived, his residence was right around the block from me. And at the time, I didn't know that I was delivering papers to the owner of a ham radio store. Later found that out. And I later went on to actually work at that store for many years. That store has quite a history, too. I have a web page on their history. But John Lopez, who passed away in 1997, W3GJF, and that call's been reassigned now. But he was really a mentor to me. He hired me at Hamburgers. He ended up acquiring the store from Howard Berger. And I worked for him for many years at Hamburgers. I got to know so many hams that way that would come into the store. I did repair work for him in the store. And really got to know him as a really good friend. And when he retired, he and his wife moved to Tennessee, and I would sked with him on the air when he was down there. And then when he died, his wife wanted to come back up here, but she didn't want to fly. So I flew down there, rented a car, and drove her back here to Pennsylvania, and took care of her until she passed away. So it was a real good relationship.
How did ham radio play a part in the choices that you made for your education and career?
Well, that's a good story because it's surprising to most people. I have very little education in electronics. I did not attend college. I was primarily self-taught. I probably knew more about radio when I was 16 than most people know, period, in ham radio today. And it just was because of my intense interest in it. I went into the Air Force in 1969 and went into avionics in the Air Force. I basically tested through the electronics course, and of course I had to take the specific course about the equipment because I didn't know the actual equipment that I was going to be dealing with. But that was a very, very good experience, the Air Force. I stayed in for a 4-year stint in the Air Force until 1973. And just to back up a little bit, I said I was licensed as a novice in 1965. Of course, novice license back then was a 1-year license. So somewhere, and I don't know the exact date, but somewhere in the later part of that year, probably in the fall of that year, I went down to the FCC office. And of course, that's what you had to do then. There were no volunteer examiners. And I took the general license. And then when I was in the Air Force, on leave, and I just don't remember exactly when that was, but it was somewhere around 1970 or 71. I was home on leave, and of course, electronics was really fresh in my mind at that point because of all the refreshing with the Air Force. I went down to the FCC, took my advanced license and also my radio telephone license, which was really good because during my Air Force career, I was stationed on Guam for a year and a half, and RCA Global had a big presence on Guam, and I worked at their transmitting station there. They had a series of 10,000-watt sideband, what they call independent sideband transmitters with two upper and two lower sidebands, so they could handle four communication channels on each sideband transmitter. And that was the way that the phone conversations got to Guam. They would come to Vietnam. They would come to Guam via satellite. There was a satellite station there. And then we would forward it on to Vietnam via HF radio. And then the return path, of course, was a receiving station, which was located at another part of the island, receiving the HF from Vietnam and then sending it back to the States on satellite. So that was an interesting job. I was in the Air Force and I also worked for RCA Global on Guam. And that radio telephone license, commercial license, came in very handy for that.
Like many hams that I knew in the 70s and 80s, they got into computers. Was amateur radio a catalyst for your entry into computing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it sure was. When I got out of the Air Force in 74, I went to work for Gerald Electronics, which was a big cable company, cable products.
Amplifier.
Well, yeah, cable products.
Right, yeah.
And it was Gerald Schaap, who was actually the governor of Pennsylvania for a while. Started that company back in the 50s because Pennsylvania was a very poor area for television reception because of the mountainous areas. And he started the company so people could get TV up in the Poconos and the higher areas of Pennsylvania. Anyhow, I went to work for that company for about a year after I got out of the Air Force. And that was a kind of a bad time for a lot of companies. Gerald was actually booming when I first started to work for them. And by the time I left a year later, they were starting to lay people off. I took a job with the government. I went to work for the U.S. Navy in research and development at the Naval Air Development Center in Warminster, Pennsylvania. And it was actually there that I got involved in computers. And I also got involved at home with computers, but in my work environment, and I think we were discussing this earlier in another conversation, when you said HP 35, it kind of rang a bell with me. HP 35 is one of the first RPN handheld calculators. I worked on the HP 9835, which was one of the first basic language desktop computers that HP made. And we had those in the lab and used them extensively. They were very primitive. They had 32-character, one-line LED displays on them, a little thermal printer. And, of course, later on, there were other peripherals that were added to it, like hard drives and things like that. But at that time, we were using cassette tapes, you know, to store data. So it was very primitive by today's standards. But that was my first real experience with a computer. And then later on, or not so much later on, but in the 70s, I started out with the Digital Group computer, which was started by Dr. Robert Suiting, W0LMD. And I don't know if you've interviewed him, but he would be a good interview for sure. He started Digital Group, and that was a company that sold basically Z80 was the processor, and he sold kits. I don't know if they had assembled products, but they may have. They were basically kit products, and you would build the memory boards and the CPU board, and there were many different boards that they sold. And we would put those together, and we had a group. I mean, it was great. We would get together a local group of Digital Group owners, and we would go into the, you know, like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, just playing with our computers and some of the things that we did with them. That was really the beginning, 1970. And then, of course, in the 80s, we got into the IBM PC and the Apple computers, and TRS-80s, I guess, came in there, you know, before that. But it was a very exciting period as far as computing was concerned.
Yeah, I remember the time. One of the reasons that I contacted you over a year ago was that I had an opportunity to look at your website hosted on your own Linux server, and was so impressed by the body of work and the detail that you presented that I knew that I should have you on the QSO Today podcast. How did you start to create, document, and share your projects?
Good question. I guess I started to do that early on. Of course, we didn't have, because of the fact that I worked for the government, we had a lot of computing power and a lot of capability earlier on than most people had. So I actually created a web page probably before anybody even knew about the web. And, I would do it in HTML language. We didn't have editors. I still do it in HTML, the hard way, just because that's what I'm used to. It doesn't make a real fancy web page, but it allows me to get a web page up very quickly and make changes, because it doesn't look like gobbledygook written by a robot. But I just started to document things early on, and of course with the All-Star project, that kind of blossomed out to a lot of how-tos for people to help them out. Whenever anybody has a problem, if it seems like there's an issue with something, then I go ahead and try to figure out how to write something that will help them out. On through the, if I want to carry on the career there, through the 80s, I did a lot of computing. I wrote some machine language programs that didn't have wide distribution, but a RIDI program written in Z80 assembly language that worked with a terminal back in the early 80s. And then throughout the 80s, I guess it was basically just computing. You know, we did a lot of playing around with computers and such. And towards the end of the 80s, then we started to see TCP/IP, which was initiated, I guess, by the TAPR, the Tucson Amateur Packet Radio Group, and the TNC 1 and TNC 2. And I built the TNC 2 kit and got on packet in the late 80s, and then progressed on to TCP/IP. And we had a big TCP/IP group. Of course, that was started by Phil Karn, KA9Q, another person that you should interview for sure if you haven't. He started the TCP/IP amateur radio. He wrote most of the software, and or in fact all of it in the beginning, and that's carried on. It still exists, but it's not as popular as it used to be. But that was basically the internet on amateur radio, you know, to make it a simple analogy. We played around with that a lot, and I was able to really experiment in that and learn a lot about the web, about how things were transmitted and received on the web, et cetera. In the internet, not the web. Web browsers and the general public using the internet throughout the 90s became more and more. And even through the early 2000s, a lot of people hadn't been introduced to the web until probably the mid-2000s. It's just amazing how, if you go back, we didn't have access to the web. And, back when we were doing this experimentation, everything was bulletin boards or word of mouth. You didn't have the ability to go on the web and research. And that is such a great thing now to be able to do that, to be able to think of something, anything. It doesn't even have to be, radio related. It can be anything and find out information about it. I mean, we just don't realize how important that is today.
I saw some articles that you wrote about actually refurbishing some boat anchors, and that there was some boat anchor radios that you actually operated before you went to Guam. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Well, I don't know about before I went to Guam. I mean, boat anchors and old radio is something that I got into more in the late 80s, early 90s.
You're talking about LMAC radios, for example.
Yeah. I mean, the radios were older, but I didn't. Well, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. When I was in the Air Force, I did have the Moldy LMAC PMR7 and the AF67 combination. And that was what I carried around with me and operated CW with that. And of course, that was maybe not quite such an antique at that time, but now it is. And if anybody has ever gone to my museum webpage, not that it's a great museum, but most of the stuff in my museum that you see online are things that were given to me, believe it or not, because I know so many old hams, and I would help them and they would help me. Actually, they would help me, in my earlier career. And then later when they weren't able to do things, I helped them. And then when they were not able to ham anymore, a lot of them would give me their equipment. And if you look at my museum, I can, go through piece by piece and tell you where it came from. And it's a lot of memories for sure. But there were a lot of hams in my life throughout my career. And of course, that's, why I collected these boat anchors.
I documented a number of boat anchors. That we're referring to boat anchors for some of maybe the new hams, we're referring to old heavy tube radios usually. There's a number of boat anchors that you've restored to almost new condition. How did you get into the restoration side of ham radio?
I guess because I like old radios, and I, you know, a lot of the old radios, of course, after 50, 60, 70 years, things need to be replaced. Capacitors in general are very, you know, very poor after that many years, especially electrolytics and some of the paper capacitors, et cetera. Actually, to be honest with you, the most reliable thing in an old transmitter like that is probably the tubes. Tubes are amazingly reliable if you take care of them. If you abuse them, they're not. But yeah, I just enjoy doing that. A lot of times I'm not too careful about keeping things original. A lot of people are much more adamant about that than I am. But I am adamant about keeping the front panel original. Beyond that, inside, if there's an improvement that can be made, I usually will make it. And I guess my Ranger, my Johnson Ranger upgrade and restoration that you see on the webpage is probably a good example of that. I mean, that was a massive change to it internally with a lot of improvements, some solid state parts, et cetera. The original designs of a lot of this equipment was not tremendous. There are a lot of flaws in a lot of the equipment that can be improved upon. And in some cases, wouldn't even be legal to put them on the air without some changes because, you know, stiffer harmonic rules now and et cetera that didn't exist back then. So, you know, it's a labor of love. I enjoy doing it. And in fact, I've kind of gotten away from it in the last several years because of the All-Star project. And I haven't had time to do it. I really need to take something else off my shelf that needs to be restored, maybe a Viking 2, and just immerse myself in it.
Well, before we talk about it, I'd like to talk about the All-Star project. But before we do, let's stick with Boat Anchor for just a second. Do you have any special shop resources that you use for radio restoration?
I've got a pretty elaborate shop as far as test equipment is concerned, probably more than most hams would have. Again, a lot of it was handed down equipment, but it's fairly good quality. I mean, I have HP test equipment, HP spectrum analyzer, signal generator. You got to have a lab power supply that you can vary and watch the current. And if you're working on tube equipment, you know, it's a real asset to have a variable high voltage power supply. And I was lucky enough to get one of those. I have a power supply that'll develop 200 milliamps at about 600 or 700 volts, and it's variable down from that. I think it uses three or four 807s in parallel as the varying element in it. Of course, today you could do that with solid state, but this was just an old piece of equipment that I had. But yeah, you need to have the equipment to do some of this stuff. Not necessarily the quality that I have, but you also need a lot of parts. And anybody that comes to my basement, which is where my little museum is, the parts actually take up more space than the museum. I have racks and racks of parts in plastic containers, segregated resistors, capacitors, switches, solid state devices, jacks and connectors, you know, et cetera. I mean, I probably have 50 boxes or more of parts. I also have a very extensive tube collection, some of which I acquired when the Navy base where I worked shut down, and they were actually throwing out tubes. So I collected up as many as I could get, but I probably have about 10,000 tubes in my collection. Not very well sorted, but I can usually find what I want.
Do you have some kind of also metalworking shop or something like that?
Very limited. Mm-hmm. I have a brake. I have a shear. I have a drill press. I don't do a lot of mechanical work beyond small pieces. In other words, I don't make cabinets or anything like that. You know, if I need to repair or make a small part, I can do that, but not beyond beyond that.
As you mentioned, you have a very extensive radio museum in your basement. And the pictures online are amazingly impressive in terms of what you have and the variety of stuff that you have. If your wife told you that you'd have to get rid of all of it except for two pieces, which two pieces would you keep?
Oh, that's a good question. First of all, I have to be modest about this. The museum I have is nowhere near as big as some museums that hams have. And of course, the Antique Wireless Association Museum up in New York is is the real one to see. But if I had to just keep two pieces, ooh, boy, I'll tell you, that would be really hard. And I'm really facing this, as many hams do as they age. I am going to have to start to downsize. And in fact, I've already started to do that to some degree. And the problem is, you know, what do you do with the equipment? I mean, a lot of this equipment, the museums that exist already have, you know, the pieces. And a lot of hams don't want it anymore. They don't want the old stuff. So that's another problem. But that isn't your question. Your question is, what two pieces? Well, it would probably be a receiver of some type and a transmitter that I could use, you know, at another location.
Or a straight key night or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's another point. I also have, and they're not out where you can see them, but it's on my ham radio webpage, a ham built a lot of very old equipment. His name is Bob Dennison. He passed away several years ago, but he was getting rid of a lot of the equipment, and I purchased a lot of it, and a lot of it he gave to me. But I belong to the Antique Wireless Association. I'm a life member, and once a year they have a 1929 or before design transmitter contest. It's not actually a contest. It's just contact as many other stations as you can. You know, they do rate, they, you do get points, but it's supposed to be more fun than anything else. And I have a 1929 Hartley oscillator, single tube transmitter that I don't keep out. But that, you know, that's one that goes on the air once a year on that one weekend. And I also have some many old receivers that he built. So I probably wouldn't want to get rid of those. It would be Eric, it would be so hard to decide. And it's something that I'm going to have to face in the future. I mean, you can't take it with you. And a lot of hams, and me included, I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay in my house, you know, for the duration of my life or not. And it's a big question.
Yeah, as I said in our earlier conversation before we actually got on here, is that I read some articles that the millennials, our children, don't want our stuff.
That's absolutely true. But I don't know, is that true now at the age they're at, or maybe when they get older? I mean, I don't know if that'll change or not, because I know when I was younger, I did want it. My grandparents did give me things, and I did collect. But I know there were people that were my age that didn't want their parents' stuff. I don't know if it's something has changed, but I do recognize that. And I don't have any children, but I have a brother and a sister, and I have nieces and nephews. And there are a lot of family archives. You know, nothing to do with radio, but there's a lot of family archives because my father was a journalist and an historian. He wrote a lot of historic articles and he collected a lot of antiques, which I have. And I would like them to stay in the family, but, you know, there's no interest and there's no other hams in my family. So, that's not going to be an option, probably, to give any of the equipment to anybody in the family.
Could you talk about your All-Star project and what All-Star is and how you got involved in All-Star and then, you know, how it's evolved into the project that you have up online now?
Well, about 5 years ago, I got involved with IRLP, Internet Radio Linking Project, and it's a VoIP method to talk to other hams.
How does it differ from Echolink, for example, then?
Well, I give a talk on this, and I do have slides on that, but Echolink, of course, was preceded all of this. Echolink, I think, goes back to the late 90s. And Echolink is VoIP. It's not limited to radio. In fact, most of the people that use Echolink are not on a radio; they're on a computer. So it's more computer to computer, kind of like Skype, but limited to amateur radio. It also has a very limited codec in it, in that the audio quality is not that great, as most hams have noted. And a lot of hams, because it's at computers, they don't often have their audio set up correctly, and it doesn't really sound that great. The Internet Radio Linking Project was started by a gentleman in Canada, and he uses a better codec. And the audio quality is much better. He also is very strict about it being strictly radio and not computer connected. So that obviously it's internet connected VoIP, but at the endpoints, you connect out to a radio and you're actually talking on a radio, not on a computer. The downside of IRLP is that, it is run by one person who doesn't release the source code. There's no experimentation. It's a very regimented format. You can only connect to one other station. You can't connect to multiple stations unless you go through what's called a reflector. And the reflectors are run by administrators that sometimes are, Gestapo operators. I really didn't enjoy IRLP. It was the first step for me, and it was my first experience of using the Raspberry Pi, because I built up IRLP with the Raspberry Pi, it was kind of a neat project, and it was neat to have a little board like that be able to do what it did. So I ran that for a while, and then I discovered All-Star.
Doug, can I hold you for a second and just ask you a question?
Sure.
Could you explain to the audience what the Raspberry Pi is?
Oh, okay. Well, I think most hams probably know what it is, but there's probably some that don't. It's a small board computer, about the size of your palm, draws about 4 watts. There's a couple of variations of it, and back when I was using it, it was just a single core processor, probably running at 600 or 700 megahertz, and it had 512 gigs or 512 megs of RAM on it. The later versions went to 4 core processors, and that's what we use now for All-Star. And one gigabyte of onboard RAM. The Raspberry Pi is very inexpensive. It's never more than about $30 or so, somewhere in that area. And it's quite a neat little board. There's a lot of experimentation that goes along with it. A lot of hams know about it, and if you don't know about it, just Google it, because there's so many projects that are involved with the Raspberry Pi, beyond amateur radio. There's a lot of interest in that board.
So then you moved on to All-Star. What is All-Star?
Okay, All-Star was started as a spinoff of what we call Asterisk. Now, Asterisk was started in 2001, and I should have my, I'd actually, as I said, do a talk on this, and I don't remember all the details. But it was started in about 2001 in that time frame as a phone PBX software system, and it would run on a PC. And what I mean by phone PBX, you know, if you're a small company and you have multiple phones, multiple phone lines, you need something to be able to manage that, to manage your voicemail, your on hold messages, that type of thing. And that's what Asterisk did. It was, you know, at first it was, rather rudimentary, software, and it developed over the years to today. It's used by, you know, many, many larger companies to handle all their phone systems. Very, very scalable phone PBX systems. But about, I'm going to say 2006, I don't remember exactly, it could have been a little bit later than that, 2007, 2008 maybe. A couple of hams decided this was a great system because it is, you know, it's a PBX, it's VoIP, it runs voice over IP, so it sent the voice, you know, digitally over the internet. And that was the beauty of it. You could connect, if you had a company and you had remote offices in other places, you could connect those remote offices to your main site, just like they were there. People could pick up a phone and dial an extension in a remote site, you know, and it would be, you know, invisible that it was there versus, you know, right in your location. And, you know, just as a sideline, I use Asterisk and I've used it for years. I have two homes, one in Philadelphia and one in Cape May, where I am now. And I have these two homes connected with Asterisk. So I can pick up the phone here, just like I can pick up the phone up in Philadelphia, and I'm on the same circuit, but it's connected by VoIP.
Yeah, I also run Asterisk in my home and have one in my business, and they're connected as well. So,
right. So you certainly understand that, but I was trying to explain that for everybody else. So about 2007, 2008, again, I'm not sure of the year, and have it in my notes, but several hams decided that, hey, you know, this Asterisk is a really great system, and we can add on to this and maybe interface this to ham radio. And the original idea was to make a repeater controller with it. So that's how it all started. And it went on and on and on. And, you know, that's what we call the ACID release of AllStar, which has been around for years. And I guess about 2 years ago, we had the BeagleBone Black. I had been trying before the BeagleBone Black came out to make AllStar run on the Raspberry Pi. Now, this is not the Raspberry Pi we have today. This is the one that the model A, I guess it was back then, Raspberry Pi. So it's nowhere near as powerful as the one we have today. So experimentally, I started working on it, and there was a ham in Europe that was working on it too, and we kind of worked together for a while, and never could make it work on the Raspberry Pi. Always had problems with audio, with USB issues, etc. And about that time, the BeagleBone Black came out. Which is another small board computer, uses a TI processor chip, and it was more powerful than the Raspberry Pi at that time. So I experimented with that and was able to make AllStar work on it. You know, it's a long story of how that all transpired. It took several months and a lot of work, a lot of compiling and fooling around with different things. But was able to make it work on the Beagle Black. About that time, another gentleman from North Carolina came on with me, and we started to develop the software, and we released the first first code for the Beagle Black was released, I think, in June 2014. And then we had a, was it 2014? Yeah, it would have been June of 2014. And then we had another release later that year. And then in the beginning of 2015, the Raspberry Pi came out. It was just about January 2015. And that was, you know, just last year. Raspberry Pi 2, which is a four-core processor and much more powerful. And we eyed that as a possibility of running it on there also. So we came out with our first release on the Raspberry Pi 2 in April of 2015. So that's kind of the story of where we went with AllStar.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I actually, I've been following your work online on the reflectors for AllStar for the last few years. And I'm running the a UHF repeater here in Israel using the BeagleBone Black in your software. And just this evening, I actually heard you speaking on your system in Pennsylvania in beautiful full quieting duplex audio. To my repeater here in Israel. So it's really cool. And it certainly takes up a lot less energy and floor space than the PC that I had running before and the laptop that I was using before.
Oh, yeah, that's the beauty of it. You know, you can replace a huge power-gobbling PC with a hard drive running all the time, with a little tiny board that draws 4 watts and has no moving parts and is very, very reliable. You know, people early on worried about SD cards. I mean, we've had systems that have been running for several years, you know, without any problems whatsoever. It's very reliable and very stable. And we are constantly working on new features and codes, and in fact, and code, and we're going to be coming out with several updates in the near future to the code. Dave KB4FXC is my partner in this, one of my partners in it, and he does a lot of the C coding, in fact, most of it, and he's very good at it. And we get along very well, and we talk often about it. In fact, you know, we try to talk at least once a week about it and get up to date. So the problem with any of this is it's a hobby, and we all have our own personal lives. Dave has a mother and father that are not well, and you know, can't spend as much time as he'd like to on it. He also has an internet company that you know, takes up a lot of his time. So, you know, it's a hobby, and people have to realize that you know, things get done when they get done. It's free, so what can you ask for free, I guess. The other person I'd like to mention is W0ANM, Chris, W0 Alpha Nancy Mike. And he does a lot of our scripting, and contributes the weather scripts that are used in our code. So Chris is another part of the team.
Oh, what does that mean exactly for an AllStar user, weather scripting?
Well, you know, some hands seem to be very interested in weather for some reason. And I guess it goes along with maybe emergency communications. They like to know what the weather is. They have weather stations, and they like to be able to report that over the air via amateur radio. So, for instance, I have a weather station here in Cape May. I have one up in Richboro, and there I transmit the information from those weather stations to Weather Underground, which is an internet weather service. And you can go and see my stations from anywhere in the world, see what the weather is, you know, wind speed, direction, temperature, humidity, barometer, et cetera, from either of these locations. And I can also bring up All-Star and have it report those conditions verbally over the air from either of those locations. So that's, you know, that's integrated into our All-Star code.
Well, that's very cool. And so it will speak the weather, or is that coming from Weather Underground?
No, it speaks it directly from your system. Now, one of the problems is that early on we were using Google Voice, and Google Voice was free to use. They've now restricted that, so we had to kind of change the way we did things a little bit. And now we formulate the verbal text from the Allison text, which is existing on the system. There, the problem is, unlike the Android and some of the PC software, Windows software, there's not really great voice software for Linux that's free. And of course, we're looking for free here. you can buy software, and we do offer that capability if somebody wants to add that on. But the free packages leave a lot to be desired in the way they sound. So basically, we formulate the weather from the Allison recorded phrases. Like Allison would say barometer, and you know she would say temperature, and you know you would form them together and add the temperature in there and make a weather forecast from that. It sounds a little bit choppy. It's not real bad, but it's better than nothing at this point.
And parenthetically, Allison is the voice of Asterisk.
That's correct. Yeah. And most people have heard that if they've called any companies and been in voicemail, they probably heard Allison.
And she's a real person, as I understand.
Yes,
she's like the VP of marketing at Digium or something like that.
Yeah, you can Google Allison. I've done it before and see a picture of her and a little bit of text about her background.
You're working on a new project, I understand, with WhisperNet. What is that project that you're doing with the hams around you in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, it's not new. It's probably new to some of the people around here, but
it's a new project for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not anything that I'm developing anything on. It's just kind of a little fun diversion. Whisper is the weak signal propagation reporter, and it's basically a beaconing system that sends out very, very low level. And most stations run 5 watts or less, and many stations run 200 milliwatts. Very low level signals on the ham bands. And when I say the ham bands, everything from the low frequency band, people that have experimental licenses are actually transmitting Whisper there. The medium frequency band also. But then 160 through you know, on up through the VHF bands. And you can go to the Whisper site and see maps of propagation at any period during the day. It's a very nice system to be able to see what the propagation is on the HF bands internationally. So the more transmitters we have on the air and the more receivers we have receiving those transmitters, the better map that we have, the better idea we have of what the propagation is worldwide. So unlike the old days where people would just run CW beacons and people would listen for them, you know, and if you heard the beacon from, you know, from Israel in the U.S., you know that propagation was good between Israel and the U.S. Now it's all automated. These transmissions are sent at 2-minute intervals. It's a 2-minute frame, and so it takes 2 minutes to send the entire frame. So, for instance, I have a transmitter that was made by QRP Labs that was a kit that I built. And it transmits, depending on what bands you have selected. And in my case, I transmit on 160 through 20 meters. So I go 2 minutes on 160, 2 minutes on 80, 2 minutes on 40, 2 minutes on 30, 2 minutes on 20, and then start all over again. So it's about a 12-minute, every 12 minutes I'm transmitting on some band. Then you can go to the map and look up my call, which the map shows the whole world. So you would zoom in on the Philadelphia area, see my call, and see what stations I've heard or what stations have heard me. And so it works out very, very well for propagation reporting worldwide. And of course, there's thousands of stations on, you know, worldwide, and many thousands of stations. So it really, really is kind of a neat system to be able to see what the propagation is.
And of course, you've got, at least what I've heard is you've got a fair number of people around you that are also doing it at the same time. So having the cluster is also quite interesting in terms of if they're propagating the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just, excuse me, it's not just DX. You know, I mean, in some of these bands, like 160 meters and the low frequency band, you know, would be relatively short distance, especially at some times of the day. So, you know, it's not just DX. I mean, we have stations that are only 30 miles apart. So, you know, can they hear each other on 160 or 80 meters or even 40 meters on a given time of day? So you can kind of determine, you know, what the propagation is, even over shorter distances.
Yeah, I was speaking in an earlier episode with Carol, KP4MD, in California, and they're doing WhisperNet on 2 meters in UHF. They actually have some interesting results with meteor scatter, airplane reflections, you know, tropospheric ducting, which, you know, makes that very interesting as well using WhisperNet.
Yeah, we haven't tried that, but that certainly would be, you know, to the VHF enthusiasts, that certainly would be very interesting. You know, and to back up a little bit, that just kind of reminds me, because in the Philadelphia area, we have the Mount Airy VHF Radio Club, which is called, you know, they're called the Pack Rats. And very, very involved VHF and above radio club. They were always tops. I don't know if they're tops anymore, but for many years they were tops in the VHF contest that some of the clubs ran, or some of the groups ran, ARRL, etc. But you know, they would be big in that kind of thing. You know, VHF, probably Whisper would be a good thing for them to run. I'm not a real big VHF, UHF person, so I don't really have a big interest there. But certainly you could run Whisper. I mean, I think the web page has it all the way up to 1296, shows charts all the way up to 1296. So there's you can view that online for sure.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes page for those people that haven't found it yet. Doug, as this is a new year of 2016, is there a new project on your drawing board for the new year?
No, not really. Well, not a new project. I mean, All Star is continuing, and that takes up a lot of my time. We're going to be developing an update to the current software. And also, we're going to be coming out with an entirely new version, which is going to be a massive update of All-Star in general. So we're going to continue to support the version that we have now, but we're going to be coming out with a brand new version that's going to be a real change from the way it is now, and a real upgrade. And for a while, it'll be probably beta and experimental. People will always be able to fall back on the current version. As far as other radio, you know, it's whatever comes up. I really would like to, you know, get involved in some of this microwave stuff with All Star, possibly VOIP. set up some mesh networks, that kind of thing. But that's just very experimental and really kind of on the side. And of course, there's always the boat anchors. I mean, I've got a basement full of them, and all I have to do is go down and pick one off the shelf that I haven't restored yet, and go to it. That's a never ending project for sure.
If you were looking back on your younger ham radio self, is there anything that you would have done differently, or something in the hobby that you would pursue that you're not pursuing now?
Probably not. I mean, hindsight's always 20/20. I was very involved in the hobby. We had, and this is another thing that I didn't mention. We have a ham radio club in Philadelphia called the Philmont Mobile Radio Club. Very, very old club. It was started in 1949, which I guess isn't that old for amateur radio. But, you know, as clubs go, that's probably pretty old in our city. And I joined that club as a novice, you know, when I was licensed in 1965. I'm still a member of that club. And just recently, and this is diverting from that subject, but another thing that hams should think about, because I'm very involved in history. I live in a 270-year-old home in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and I've done a lot of restoration on it, and was president for many years of our historical society in the township that I live in. So I'm very involved in history, but I'm very, very interested in preserving history. The Philmont Mobile Radio Club, from the beginning, had newsletters. It goes back to 1949. And they had all these newsletters. In fact, there were very, very few that were missing. So I took on the task last year of digitizing every single piece of printed material and photos that that club had. If you're familiar with the plastic containers that you would buy at Walmart or any of the stores, the big plastic containers, there's about six of those that comprise the entire amount of material that I'm talking about. So I scanned every single, they call it the blurb, their newsletter, for all those years, several thousand photos, all of their legal documents. They were involved with the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. They had their station there for many years. All kinds of things, anything that pertained to the history of that club that we still had in the archives. And I put it all onto one DVD, which we're going to, we haven't done it yet, but we're going to distribute it to every club member. And I would encourage other clubs to do that. It's not that hard to do. Scanners now are automatic scanners are not that expensive. It would be a good club investment to do that. If you have that history, you really want to preserve it. And getting it onto a DVD and distributing it to all the club members is a great way to preserve it, because it's going to be, you know, at 50 or 100 different places, and probably won't be lost. And that's a good thing. At that point, you can decide if you want to dispose of the paper or not, because the paper is always a problem with clubs, because with clubs, they usually don't have a central place. This paper goes from the current secretary's home to the next secretary's home, or whoever in the club is the archivist. And it doesn't always get in the best environmental position. So a lot of times it gets destroyed or damaged in some way. Once you get it digitized and on computers, it's not going to get damaged, and it's going to be preserved. So that's really a good thing to do.
Yeah, and I guess given the cost of cloud storage, that, you know, you can also put a copy of it up in the cloud.
You could put it anywhere you can store information, and that would be a good idea. In this case, it ended up being about 6 or 7 gigabytes of data. The club also has a movie. So there was a movie that they made back in the 50s, and that's included on the DVD. So, you know, I mean, it probably wouldn't be that much for most clubs, but you know, that's not a lot of data nowadays when you talk about terabyte hard drives.
What advice would you give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
Get involved, you know, whatever your interest level is. I think, and we've talked about this a lot, you know, hams today are everybody has a cell phone. And the old argument is, well, I can get on my cell phone and talk to my buddy and, you know, halfway around the world. Why do I need ham radio? And in fact, there's a couple of different applications for phones now, apps for phones where you can use push to talk on them. You know, just like it's a walkie-talkie and or a handheld. I don't know what the answer to that is. You know, the mystique of having your own ham station and transmitting your own RF that goes around the world. I mean, to me, that's just phenomenal. If you don't have that, then I don't know how you can instill that in somebody. I really don't know. I think schools have to get more involved, and maybe local clubs need to get more involved in trying to get new hams in. I know the ARRL says that ham radio is at its highest level of licensing in many years. But I don't really see that. I don't understand where that's coming from, because I don't hear young hams on the air. Most of the hams that I talk to are my age or older, and I'm 65. There's not very many hams that are younger than 30 years old, I don't think. I mean, and I don't see them, and maybe they're licensed and not operating or something, but. The other problem today is nobody has time to do anything. They work and they come home and they don't have time to do anything. I don't know how that was different back, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, but somehow it was. I had two jobs. And that's another thing that I didn't talk about here, in my career path, which I'd like to just briefly talk about. In 1974, I went to work for the U.S. government, and I worked for the U.S. government until 1969, when the Naval Air Development Center in Warminster, Pennsylvania, closed. It was shut down in a base closure, and I retired from the government at that time. But in about 1987, I was working in with a physics professor. Former physics professor, but he was now working for the government. We had set up at what we called a magnetics lab, doing magnetic experimentation. And that laboratory was at the Naval Air Development Center in Warminster. He and I talked about starting a company and what was needed in industry. You know, we were open to anything. So, you know, we kind of researched a little bit. We had somebody visit the lab from California one day, and he said, you know what we need is we need some way to be able to test these disks that go into hard drives. Now, you got to remember that this was the early time in hard drives. This was in the mid 80s, and hard drives were small, and they were not terribly reliable and very expensive. So we started to experiment, and we came up with a method to measure the magnetic properties of a disk. And the disk is a piece of metal with a substrate put on top of it that's magnetic, where the actual data is stored. We came up with it, and the problem was that the manufacturers had to actually destroy the disk, take a piece out of it, put it in what is called a vibrating sample magnetometer to be able to measure the magnetic properties of that disk. And they would get a hysteresis loop and be able to measure what the magnetic qualities were of the disk. And this is not bit quality. This is overall raw magnetic property. So we came up with a method to be able to do that using a laser. if you bounce a laser at a certain angle off of a disc, and use a detector to detect the laser that's reflected off the disc, you can actually create a hysteresis loop at that point of the disc. You can create a hysteresis loop that would tell you the magnetic properties. Our company was called Innovative Instrumentation Incorporated. It was a very successful company. That's where I made my money. And the company ran for about 22 years. We shut down in about 2007. At that point, the industry had gotten to the point where they didn't need this measurement anymore. And it also was a very good time to shut down because that was just at the point where the market crashed and everything. So we had probably about 10 different products over that period of time. I still have a website up for the company, innovinst.com, and it shows some of the products that we made. I keep the website up only for historical reasons, but that gives a little bit of insight on what I was doing. And I kind of got off the subject there, but I had two jobs. I was renovating a house, an old house, plus I was doing all this amateur radio stuff. And then hams today say, I don't have time. They have one job. You know, I mean, I don't know why. I don't know what the answer is to that.
I think that social media takes up an awful lot of time in people's lives. And being interconnected now to the office with cell phones and smartphones and stuff, I think that the boundaries between, you know, work and home have gotten blurred. I can see that in my life. You know, I think that's probably that, you know, people are maybe now they're not overly busy, but they're so connected to everything else that it just takes up a lot of time.
Yeah, when we left work, of course, there were people that would have had jobs that you required them to be available when they were off hours, but I didn't have that kind of job. And I also had, you know, worked at a facility, and this is another thing, the Naval Air Development Center in Warminster was a really unique facility. All the astronauts trained there in our centrifuge, which still exists there. It's not in operation, but it's kind of a museum event center now. But I mean, the opportunities at my employment were phenomenal. We had every kind of physicist, engineer, technician, you know, you name it, there working in just about every kind of field you could think of. So if you wanted to learn about something, you could find the right person and learn about it. And that was probably, you know, one of the things that I just cherish very much, having been able to work at that facility.
Well, Doug, you've been a fine guest, and I really appreciate your agreeing to come on the QSO Today podcast. So with that, I want to wish you 73 and thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Eric. It was great to be able to talk with you.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. Please check out the show notes for this episode at www.qsotoday.com. Put WA3DSP in the search box at the upper right corner of the homepage. QSO Today is available in the iTunes Store and in the Stitcher podcast app for both iPhone and Android. It appears to be also available in a bunch of other podcast apps, so just search on QSO Today in those apps. There are links to these places on the QSO Today website. Please take the time to join the QSO Today community. Our community at this time receives my weekly blog post as an email introducing the next episode, and we have a Facebook page where many of our QSO Today guests are available for questions. There are buttons on the website and on the show notes pages for these locations. I promise not to spam you or share your email address with anyone. Until next time, this is Eric for Z1UG 73.